listeners, you're listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. On the show, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier, and today we are so excited to have a very special guest on the show. Our guest is Sherry Kramer. She's a playwright and professor who has been writing plays for 50 years and teaching playwriting for 40. Her book about meaning-making and time-bound art, Writing for Stage and Screen, Creating a Perception Shift in the Audience, was published this summer by Methuen Publishing, and her website is sherrykramer.net. Sherry, welcome to Beckett's Babies.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, we're so excited to talk to you about your work. But first, we'd love to ask you about your earliest memory. So what is something you remember before you ever heard of theater?
Well, I actually don't remember anything before I ever heard of theater because my parents took all of us to the theater at such a young age that I thought that the theater was for sleeping. The orchestra was for sleeping. It was like you go, you sit in your, you get dressed up, you sit in your chair, and you sleep. you're really little, but And then you wake up every so often, and then you take in a few things, and then you go back to sleep. Opera is particularly good for this.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I can't imagine the dreams you had.
Yes, well, it's the way most of us actually consume opera now. But my earliest memory is going to kindergarten. I don't have, like, super early memories, but going to kindergarten and eating the snack every day was saltines and orange juice. In one of those soft plastic cups, you know, I don't think they exist anymore. I'm sure they were like incredibly toxic, but they were like a soft plastic, like a aquamarine cup.
Oh, interesting.
And saltines, which we never got at home, and orange juice. So that's my earliest memory.
Yeah, a sensory memory. And it sounds like you really enjoyed the snack.
I did. For one thing, you know, it's like when you go to your friend's house and they have all this food that you don't have at your house.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the big deal. And we did have orange juice, but we didn't have the combination of the saltine and the orange juice, which if you think about it, it's salt, fat, and sugar. A snack.
What could a
5-year-old want?
Okay, cool. So your earliest memories of the theater are sleeping.
waking and sleeping.
And then how did you start making your own stamp on the theater? When did that start happening?
Well, I didn't start off as a playwright. I started off as a poet.
Okay.
Which I think is pretty typical. And one of the things that I also try to teach my students is that just because you're a bad poet doesn't mean you aren't a poet. You are a poet. You're just a bad one. apparently, that's what I was, but it did not stop me. I did lose all of my early work in Hurricane Irene, which is the way that goes. But now, you know, everyone... Wow. Who doesn't have a flooding experience to talk about, or fire? It's floods or fires from here on out. So I did write a lot of bad poetry, and then I graduated to writing plays in college, my senior year.
Oh,
I started writing plays.
How did that happen?
I was in Florida on the beach, and I was peeling an orange, and I said to myself, I wonder if I could make this orange easier to peel all in one strip by saying it was easier to peel it all in one strip. So that's what I wrote a play about that.
Whoa.
Obviously, I was very influenced by Ionesco and that whole movement. Yeah, so that's where I started.
And that's super interesting.
And I'm also seeing that there is a theme because it has oranges in it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that connects right back to that orange juice.
Yes, it does. Apparently, I'm the same person over and over again. So that's where it started. And the play was called Orange. And I performed in it as well. It was a two-character play.
Oh, you performed in your own play?
Yes, I did.
Oh, wow.
And at college, we did it. And I got to wear a tuxedo. I had this tuxedo, which was great.
So did you write it? Sorry, did you write it because you to play in it, or because you couldn't find actors, or?
Well, I wrote it, and then I was back after winter break, back to school, and mm-hmm. so then I don't really know how it happened that we decided to perform it. But it just seemed logical. Not only that, but I did have the tuxedo. And it specified that it was something like, well, you know, this is 1974 or maybe five, probably four. And it specified two women who think they are men, who think they are women, who think it was like some long discovery of gender fluidity thing. And so it seemed like the right thing to do, to perform it myself. Hmm. And then somebody else, I can't even remember who was the other person. I think I was Jack, but I can't remember the other character.
And were you successful in making the orange easier to peel?
Well, yes, but you do it by soaking it in water.
Oh, okay.
Not in saying that it's easier to peel all in one strip.
Okay, but, so then after this experience, was it like you just started writing play after play? You caught the bug, or
I did. I immediately wrote a longer play, which was my senior thesis. And my advisor was Frank Bedart, a poet.
Wow.
And I don't know what he thought, but he signed off on it, and so. And then that was performed at Wellesley, which is where I went to school. After I graduated, they did a production of it on the main stage. And I came back for that.
Cool. But
by then I was already at Iowa in the fiction workshop.
Oh, so you were also a fiction writer?
Yes. I was accepted to fiction. Back then, it was kind of crazy what Aki Brownstein, who ran the Playwrights Workshop, did. He provisionally accepted, like, I don't know how many, it could have been six, it could have been 12, I don't know, playwrights for first year. And then he just cut almost everybody at the end of the semester. So you weren't actually accepted until after your first semester, because Aki believed that everybody has one good play in them. Mm. And he really can't tell if you have any dramatic instinct from reading one play. So you got in on the one play, and then he started cutting you.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Did that create a lot of hard feelings?
Well, it was just despair because, as we know, a lot of people, we had people who had, you know, it was wives. I mean, there weren't that many women in the workshop who had wives and families.
Right.
And children, some of them, and they uprooted their life to come to Iowa City. And then at the end of 3.5 months, they were out of there.
Wow.
So that's not a very pretty scenario. But Aki's feeling was that you're not doing anybody a favor by telling them they're a playwright when they're not. And on the one hand, I agree with him. And on the other hand, I know in my bones that the person who I believe is talent free is the one who's going to win the Pulitzer Prize. So it's hard to know all the time who's got it and who doesn't. Yeah. But yeah, so anyway, I made the cut and then I stuck around. And I was already in the fiction workshop, so.
That's just so interesting to me about knowing, like, what is this instinct? You know, how do you know what they have or they mm-hmm. don't have? And then, because it just feels so subjective.
It does. I will tell you, having done, read admissions for playwriting at Iowa, Graduate Iowa, Graduate, the Michener Center for Writers, and UT, the regular playwriting program, for many years, that there's a difference between writing and playwriting, which we all know. But one of the things that happens is you get these incredibly, we would oftentimes, particularly for the Michener Center, but often for Iowa as well, we would get like the Harvard student. And those people were hyper-articulate and hyper-verbal. Mm. They could really write up a storm, but it didn't mean they could write a play. Mm. So, I don't mean to single out Harvard for this, but
they're fine.
But you felt more justified if they were like a super smart, super articulate Harvard student. You felt more justified saying, "Yeah, they don't need to come here. they have other options."
So. I feel like this gets to one of the perennial debates in teaching writing, which is, do you think that those kinds of skills can be taught? Like if somebody is super articulate and a great writer but doesn't really understand how to write a play, is that something you could teach them, or is that not really the goal of that kind of a program? Is it better to bring in someone who already knows how to write a play and then help them develop their craft?
Well, interestingly enough, I was on a panel once at the AFA convention. Everybody else was a fiction writer. And from Iowa, we were all Iowa fiction writers. And mm-hmm. I was the only playwright on the panel. And the title was, "Can Writing Be Taught?" Not to mince words. And I don't know if it happens. I don't know what happens on a graduate level. I think that on graduate level, what you do is you give writers a way to see what it is they do organically, naturally, and well. And so it's like an enhancement machine, mm-hmm. I think, because by the time you get to graduate school, you kind of know who you are as a writer. I could be wrong about that, but people used to go to graduate school also much later than they do now. Mm-hmm. I went right out of college, but I was the only person there my age in both workshops. And that's not the case now.
Do you feel that you knew who you were as a writer when you started? You were like 22. Yeah.
I was 21. I had no idea.
Yeah.
None whatsoever. But I will say that teaching undergraduates at Bennington College, it's quite extraordinary how if you get a person who's really just trying to figure everything out, which is what you get with a freshman, you get with an 18-year-old. And if you throw a couple of portals, I would say, although now portal it's a bad word now because it means you're trying to find out about your healthcare. But if you... I must get on my portal and see about my lab results. But if you throw a couple of doorways in front of them and say, walk through, here's how you walk through, you'll be astonished. I'm teaching a class for the second time this semester called Doubleness. And I do not understand why it works. It's completely beyond me. But the plays that the kids write in that class are astonishing.
Cool.
It's like, what is going on? So I don't think you make them into writers. I think you just give them permission. Mm-hmm. You give them a set of keys and say, here are these doors, and walk through them. But the thing about the dramatic instinct is, yeah, there are people who can unlock that door and people who can't. Mm-hmm. And you can just see it.
Yeah.
Well, this is leading me to this question. Like, how has teaching inspired your own writing?
I think it reminds me how... I was going to say how simple it is, but simple is a funny word. I guess what I mean by simple is how, if you just unbuckle your expectations and all of those, so all of that stuff, how it just flows, because you see it happening in the classroom. You see the students who cannot be hung up by things. You just see them literally become a river that just goes downstream. But sometimes you have students who write really good plays and they are self-torturers. You know, what it's all anguish. I had a student who cried every week in my office her first year. And when she, every time she started a play for all 4 years at Bennington, she came into my office 4 or 5 times saying, "I can't do it. I just can't do it. I don't know how to write a play. I don't know what to write about. I can't do it." And then she would write this wonderful play. And those students, you learn just to leave them alone and say, "This is your process. I'm sorry." The way you write, and I can't do anything about it. So let me know if I can help you once you get the play written.
One of the things I found so opaque and mysterious when I was in my 20s about, you know, growing as a playwright was learning how to revise. I felt like I knew how to write a first draft, and a lot of the teaching I had been given at that point was about, you know, kind of unlocking, giving myself permission, you know, how to just kind of write a first draft. But then I would end up with this draft that had been so fun to write but was full of problems, and you know, and then I just didn't know where to go, and I people would talk about revising, and I would ask, you know, how do I do it, and they would say, well, you just kind of have to figure it out. You know, and yeah. And so I'm always thinking now that I teach playwriting about how to help my students learn that, and I'm wondering what approach you take.
Well, in reality, I always said I don't teach writing at all. I teach rewriting.
Yeah.
Because you can teach rewriting.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
how do you do it?
Obviously, I do it poorly, but I can teach it. But unfortunately, rewriting is chapter, I believe, 11 of my book, and the book that you that is published only goes up to chapter 5 or 7. So, yeah, it just goes up to chapter 7. So, I can't tell you because it's in book 2. No. And it is one of my favorite chapters. There are many things in the book that actually are good tools for that. The whole teaching, what I try to teach all the time is a non-narrative attention to your work. That if you can train yourself to look at the non-story patterns that your play is creating, that you have a much better chance of rewriting it. So we want to look at systems. We want to look at your repeating patterns in the work. And I also do have a lot of exercises in book 2, of course, not book 1, that are, that have visual components where you draw maps and charts, all asking you to have a structured relationship with your play that is not verbal or narrative. It's not textural. So the stronger you can make that relationship with the work, the better chance you have to rewrite it. And the thing about systems, once you start paying attention to systems, you are less likely to ruin your play by cutting out the wrong things.
Yeah.
I mean, as you know, your dramaturg with the best intentions in the world will have you cut out something that doesn't pay off in a way that they want.
Yeah.
Or usually a director does this. That's because they only understand one way of forward motion. And a play doesn't just go forward in a, you know, from right to left or left to right. Mm-hmm. It has vertical as well as horizontal movement. That is in book one, the issue of the orchestral score. Mm-hmm. And the fact that when you do rewrite, you only rewrite the melody. 9 times out of 10, your rewrite is about the story. But there are all those other instruments that are playing that match the old melody, and now you've changed the melody. Mm. So now you're in trouble. But we have so much emphasis and attention spent on the melody of our work, where sometimes the meaning isn't carried in the melody. Sometimes the melody is just supporting. I mean, this is the example that I always give. Go ahead, tell someone what happens in Waiting for Godot, speaking about Beckett babies. yeah, tell me about that melody. You won't get very far. You can't give anybody the experience of Waiting for Godot by talking about its melody.
Right. That's almost beside the point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And even though most of us are not writing Waiting for Godot, that happens to some degree in every... There are some relentlessly narrative plays out there. I don't like them, but they're out there and they're successful. I talk about this in the story versus plot, story and plot subject. Mm-hmm. So the more tension, so the way I teach playwriting, rewriting is the more attention you can spend to the parts of your play that aren't its story, the better chance you have to rewrite it richly and fully and not destroy it in the process.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I have a question. So you mentioned systems, and as I was reading your book, a question that came to mind is when we're looking at work or to play, film, how do we know what system we're following? Like, how do we know it's the correct system we're following?
You mean when you're just watching?
Watching, reading a play, or...
If you know that you're watching it, that's probably bad. I mean, the thing about... Mm. The system is a elegant, subconscious, I believe no one writes them on purpose, magic act. So let's say you're looking at Tennessee Williams' Streetcar Named Desire, which most people know, right? You both know the play.
Yeah.
So let's say that, you know, Stella is talking about how Stanley took her slippers and smashed all the light bulbs on their wedding night. Mm-hmm. And let's say that Blanche is busy trying to hide from naked light bulbs. And Blanche is buying a little paper lantern to hide the naked bulb so that she won't be exposed to its relentless glare. And let's say that the metaphor she uses to talk about the death of her husband is a blinding searchlight was put out and there's never been any light stronger than this candle since then. And let's say that Stella's name is Stella for star. And what, do you all remember the name of the newspaper that the young boy comes to collect for?
Oh gosh.
No. It's the Evening Star.
Okay.
Uh-huh. It is a relentless system of light. Mm-hmm. And it goes through every part of the play. When Stanley is talking to Stella,
isn't that?
But you're not aware of it when you're watching it.
Right.
And Stanley, when he's talking about, won't it be great when your sister is gone and we can get those colored lights of turning and burning, it's a metaphor for sex. As if there aren't enough metaphors for sex. this play. So what happens, though, if you can imagine that you take a piece of paper, it's the accordion exercise or demonstration, which is in the book. Every time the system flares up with a discussion of light, with a reference, either we see a light and what a character does about it, or we hear about a story about a light, or we have it used as a metaphor for something. All of those moments connect to the other moments. They are an extended rhyme scheme. Yeah. And the way that any extended rhyme scheme works is it's a same, not same. We have the pleasure of the familiarity and the delight that it isn't the same, quite the same. Because mm-hmm. a rhyme that's just the same word over and over again is, I don't know who writes like that, but some people do and get by with it. But what you want is the same, not same of it. And so every time that happens, we don't have to hear, oh, this is a moment about sex. Oh, this is a moment about Blanche's fear of being seen. Oh, you know, and we, it is a callback to all the moments before it that were also about light. And that's the way a system works. It connects your play to itself relentlessly without annoying you. David Lindsay Abaire's Rabbit Hole does this beautifully. So that everything you look at ultimately is screaming, Danny is not here, the little boy. The pajamas, the creme brulee that was made for him, the her brother Arthur who killed himself, Rose Kennedy's dead sons, the pajamas, the robot sheets. All these things are all screaming, Danny, Danny, Danny. Well, if you had a play that did nothing but scream, Danny's dead, and I can't go on without him, that would be really boring. Mm-hmm. So you shouldn't be aware of any system unless you're taking a playwriting class. Be aware of it. But it creates a significant path for you to walk on,
right,
that will guide you through a work with a security that you sense, but do not have to register fully. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So now I'm thinking back to Sam's question about rewriting, is that if there are, maybe this is one way of troubleshooting a play, is that if there was one too many systems in a play, or can there be multiple systems in a play? Oh,
well, if you want to see a system orgy, I recommend you read House of Blue Leaves by John Guare. That man is system mad. And what you get is Buried Child is a good example too. Mm-hmm. There's usually a central or a primary system that is supported by all the other systems. So in House of Blue Leaves, I guess the primary system is fame that everyone wants, because all of their monologues are pretty much about that. They have that direct address. Mm-hmm. So it isn't a problem if there are lots of systems, because it is sort of an organic thing that they will support. They will feed into your primary system. And sometimes you can have two primary systems. You can have three. You can have three that are more or less equal. I mean, the Rabbit Hole, the David Lindsay Abaire play, one can say that motherhood is the primary system because you have all these mothers. Izzy, who's a mother to be, and Nat, who's lost her son Arthur, and poor Rose Kennedy, who lost her sons. As well as the main character, Becca. But you could also say that grief is the primary system.
Yeah.
Because that is what connects all those women in their motherhood, is in their grief. and these are not competing. It's a lot of Venn diagramming going on.
Yeah.
Where things are overlapping. But I mean, if it's just busy, then you might have a problem because you can't, all the paths have to converge ultimately at the end of your play.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's funny is that if you write a play, you theoretically will have no knowledge or consent of your systems. But after you write it, you can see them if you look.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was one of the things I found so helpful about meeting with you about my plays at Iowa was learning how to recognize those systems that I, you know, had kind of unconsciously created.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. And then once I could see them, I could start to work with them.
Yes, they can protect you from dangerous errors of rewriting, of editing, yeah. cutting them out. And they can also be, they're kind of like if you were in an airport and you're on one of those moving walkways, mm-hmm. you can hop on and it'll carry you through the play.
Mm, yeah. Mm. Past all the unnecessary detours.
And they can carry you. And they can carry your baggage. They, you know,
yeah,
they're really good at baggage carrying. What they and they connect the play and they allow the play. Oh, I had a fiction writer. This is in the book, but I had a fiction writer at the Michener Center, and he one day he just like almost screamed in frustration. He said, "I can't stand this. Plays are always." Always about something, and what they are about is themselves. He was really smart, but he was a really sort of primitive, natural writer of fiction. Mm. And the fact that he just couldn't amble around for 1,000 words here, 500 there, because you can't do that in the theater,
right?
Made him crazy, because you cannot. You can't send them over to this corner of the jungle and then leave them in the theater. Mm-hmm. We're time bound. We don't have any time to waste.
Yeah. People will get very unhappy.
Well, they'll get lost. They'll get lost. Now, Annie Baker and those kinds of plays, they perfected, you're not going anywhere and you really don't know where you are for 2 hours. Mm. And then at the end, then she'll tell you. But that's different than sending people places that will not converge at the end.
Right. Well, this kind of leads us to, I think, one of the other ideas in the book, which is perception shifts, which you taught us a lot about. And I'm wondering if you can tell our listeners what perception shifts are and why they're so important in plays.
Yes. It will only take about 500 or 600 pages. I'm ready to do it.
They're going to rush out and buy the book after this, I'm sure. So just give them a little teaser.
Okay. The teaser is that amazing moment when you hear a joke and you go, oh, of course, it could only be this. Why didn't I see it before? That is some sort of spring-loaded moment inside us that we crave. Mm. And we always will, as far as I can tell. Evolutionarily, I don't know where it stems from. But there is something about seeing the world and being told, oh, you saw that incorrectly. Here's how it really is. That drives us on a primal level. Because it happened in great plays. And, you know, I'm going to leave out Shakespeare, okay? Just assume that I'm always leaving out Shakespeare. Here. Great guy, good wordsmith, but there's something about a perception shift when you see the world new. And a couple of things. One part of it is that you go, oh, well, you all know that ad, I could have had a V8, when the person gets the side of their head and realizes that they could have had a nutritious drink instead of a, you know, a soda.
I don't think I know that ad.
Nah, it's too young. You're too young. But it's exactly the way that the mechanism of a joke works. You think you're looking at something, you think you can see it, and then you're told, no, this is how you see it. So in a play, I mean, Sam Johnson says that nothing excites the mind so much as the realization that you have been wrong.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
And one of the things that's so cool about it is that we think that people go to the theater to be validated in their ideas about the world, which is not why we go. We actually go to find out that we've been wrong. And I think, but this is just my theory, that the reason why we like to find out that we're wrong and that the real true way to see the world, this situation, these people's lives exists is because it gives us comfort in the great mystery of life, where nothing makes sense day to day in the real world, speaking for myself. And yet when you go to the theater, everything that you think you understand turns out to be wrong, but there is a correct way of seeing it. And that is comforting.
Wow.
But I can't prove that. That's just me trying to figure out why we like a perception shift. Or why we need it. Because when we get it, that's it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the example I always give is the sixth sense, mm-hmm. which I assume you all have seen.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was for many years the top grossing film in the world. And then I think Titanic took it down.
So a lot of my students, because I teach, you know, and kind of intro to playwriting class, and I've also taught playwriting to kids in the past, and a lot of my students will kind of know this intuitively, that the twist ending is like really exciting and satisfying. And so often what it will be is a story in which someone's been talking to their best friend all along, and then at the very end of the play, the best friend turns out to be a figment of their imagination. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've seen this play. So I'm just wondering if you can, and I don't mean to laugh at them, you know, it's like, onto something. They're totally onto something. And also it's almost like they haven't quite figured out why that is a satisfying story. And so they kind of throw it in at the end to get an effect they're going for, but they don't, but it's not kind of, the story itself isn't really set up to make that satisfying. So how do you execute a perception shift in a way that actually can be surprising, but also feel properly set up?
Well, unfortunately, the way it's done is with pointers.
Okay, yeah.
The way they make it satisfying is if you go back to the beginning and read it again, you'll go, oh, of course. Right. It was obvious that this was an imaginary friend.
Right.
Why didn't I see it? But lots of times if it's late to the party decision, there won't be any pointers. And a pointer is a lie that tells the truth. You know, when you're watching it, you can't go, oh, wait a minute. That's an imaginary friend. I can tell because remember when she says this, this, and this? One of the great pleasures of teaching Sam Shepard's Buried Child. And do you both know the play?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Too well.
Is half the class doesn't know that the buried child is the son of Tilden and Hallie, the mother.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So when that happens.
Yeah.
The class that doesn't know that is very bored by the play. It says, I just thought it was stupid. Nothing really happened. And then, so I go, uh-huh. And then the other half goes, well, you do know that is Tilden's son. They go, what? And then the other class goes, yeah, remember when he says, my flesh and blood is, you know, actually that's Dodge that says that, but he says, my son is buried in the back. And they go, oh, yeah. But they ignored it. Because they didn't, it's just part of the genius of the play. But it has to be there. That line has to be there, and it has to be ignored by the audience in order for the for the reveal to work, which is fascinating.
I talk about it.
I talk about it in the book about the, you know, the gorilla on the basketball court phenomenon.
Yeah.
The gorilla is there, I believe, for what is it, 10 seconds? In the middle of a basketball game, which is not something you normally see.
And this is for people who don't know this. This is a video in which, people are passing a basketball. And so the study participants will be asked to watch this video of people passing a basketball back and forth. And then...
And count how many times the ball is passed.
Right. They're given a task. Right.
Yes.
And then at some point during the video, this man in a gorilla costume walks into the shot and... He doesn't pass the basketball. I think he just walks through.
Yeah, he doesn't pass. It would probably be different if he passed
the basketball. It would be different. Yeah. And most people who watch this video don't notice that this guy has been there because they're so busy counting. Yeah.
Yeah. It's called inattentional blindness. And it is something that we exploit up the wazoo in our art form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we put the clues, if you will, but what we just call them a pointer, because when we hear Dodge say that we have different ways of ignoring the pointers, we either think that, True West, when one of the brothers says, "You don't have to worry about me. I'm not the one you have to worry about." We go, "Oh yes, you are. 'Cause he's the big brute." And we think his brother Austin is like the mamby-pamby screenwriter. He wouldn't hurt a fly. And by the end of the play, we understand that he's not the man, the one, the brother you have to worry about. That Austin, the screenwriter, is the violent one. Mm-hmm. So it is in our apprehension and assumption that you have the lie that tells the truth. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of in charge of, in the same way that we're in charge of it, for some reason, editing out the gorilla because it doesn't make sense. The problem with using the gorilla on the basketball court as a metaphor for what we do is that when they told people there was a gorilla there, everybody said, "No, I didn't see it." And in the theater, in the comparable situation, you have to go, "Remember that gorilla?" And everyone has to go, "Oh my God, yes, I just forgot about it."
Right.
So we have to both not see and see the gorilla. And that's tricky.
Yeah, that's the hard thing. You have to find another way to underline that moment without making it obvious. I mean, in The Sixth Sense is full of pointers, but then they also, don't they have a montage at the end where it takes you back through all the pointers so you can kind of see them with fresh eyes?
Yes, it's masterful.
Yeah.
It's so amazing that my favorite is the scene at dinner when she's alone.
Yeah.
But you think that she's just mad at her husband.
Ignoring
and
him.
Ignoring him. So it's all there. But we see it through, you know, a biased frame of reference.
Right. Yeah. And the trick in a play is that in most plays, at least, you can't do a montage like that. And so how do you rely on your ability to make them remember things?
Well, because you have to make them remember and not remember. But there are, you need the instinct. I mean, Martin McDonagh can do anything he wants to you, and he only has to do it once. Mm. He's kind of a genius. In Beauty Queen of Linnaean, the mother says, "She burned my hand. She poured boiling oil in my hand." And you just don't want to believe her, so you don't. Right? There's no trickery involved, except your own feelings that you want Maureen to be okay and to leave and have a life, and you hate Mag. Mm. And you don't believe her because she pours her urine down the sink. So his trickery is all in the characters and the way you feel about them.
Yeah.
So, and we're also told that Maureen was only, she said, is only released from the loony bin under her mother's recognizance, right? Mm-hmm. Maureen can't go to America with Pato or Pato. I never know how to say his name. She can't go. She could never have gone with him. She's really nuts. But we don't believe that, because every time the mother says she can't, she tells him she can't, you know, she's crazy. She lost her mind when she went to England. And we just go, oh, that bitch is just trying to ruin her daughter's life. And we have to think that in order to think it's okay when she kills her.
Right.
So there's no trickery involved. It's absolute, flat out, making us see the right thing in the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and relying on our own inclination to be like, that can't be true. I don't believe
yes.
that.
Yes. Yes. I mean, he manipulates us beautifully by making Mag seem so horrible when she rips up the invitation to the party, you know, when all that stuff. I mean, he's really good, but it's completely above ground. It isn't like The Sixth Sense at all. Mm-hmm. Right? The Sixth Sense is a different animal. But what's interesting is the kind of thing that McDonough does in his work is, of course, reproducible. And the Sixth Sense is not.
Right.
I can't pronounce his name, Shyamalan? M. Night Shyamalan?
I don't know.
I'm sorry. Forgive me. I can't pronounce any names. He's been incapable of reproducing the Sixth Sense, and he's tried multiple times. You know?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like,
yeah.
Where do you go from there? Yeah.
Well, because it's fabulous. I mean, I worship that film. But the things that McDonough does are so deeply sourced and rooted inside character and the way we feel about the characters, not about trickery or sleight of hand. Mm-hmm. That he can do it all day long.
Right.
You know? And he does. He pretty much does. I don't think any of his plays can match The Beauty Queen, but he can still do it. So that, to answer your question, certain kinds of perception shifts are easier mm-hmm. to do than others. If we look at Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, mm-hmm. that's a secret which is withheld from the audience and half of the cast for the length of the entire play, right? Mm-hmm. And then the reveal happens. And when that reveal happens, we are forced to understand that we have been watching a completely different play than we thought we had.
Yeah, and then so we kind of look back over everything.
Mm-hmm. It actually is just like The Sixth Sense. But then so is The Beauty Queen of Linnane, that you go, oh, everything I thought is wrong. You know, they're not fighting because, you know, they're bitter. They're fighting because they're broken. Mm-hmm. The real game that they've been playing all along is this game about their son that they do not have. It's a life or death situation, not just two sort of messed up people having their way with the guests. Mm-hmm. It's kind of extraordinary. And that happens in Beauty Queen. The metaphor I use is that the magician takes the tablecloth off the table underneath the play setting. But instead of all the dishes and the cutlery and the glassware landing on a bare table, there's a whole nother table setting underneath it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. So that blows our mind.
Wow. So much to think about.
I know. Yeah. I was just thinking that, you know, I feel like everything I write, I'm always chasing that perception. So like, how do I make this? And I do find myself in the early drafts or the plays that I write, they they tend to start as a mystery, you know, like, or like, oh, this is a comedy, but right now it feels like a mystery and I'm writing a mystery right now. And because I think I inherently want to chase that perception shift, and I think I could only find it in a mystery.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good way to go. Remember that even though this sounds completely counterintuitive, that the way you make a mystery is by telling us more, not less.
Oh, say more about that.
Well, this is the main thing that I combat with my young students, is that they think in order to write a play, they have to hide things from the audience. Mm-hmm. So that you can literally get the first 15, 20 pages and there's no context. There's you can't tell anything that's happening. And then if you get them to talk, they'll say, well, see, he was married, blah, blah, blah. And they have this whole backstory and all this history. And you go, in the name of God, in the play, you are killing me. Because we can't remember anything without context. We can't process anything without context. And we can't care about anything.
Yeah.
But the other thing, and the most important thing for you writing it, is that if you write enough, you're going to write those pointers without knowing it. You're going to write those lies that tell the truth, and then they'll be there for you to activate at the end of your play.
Mm-hmm. When you get specific in your writing, you can't help but add in the pointers. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it just happens. Mm-hmm. I have never, ever had a playwright that has been in a class of mine. I'm not talking about everybody who is a freshman who takes a class, but I have never had a playwright who did not generate pointers organically and naturally. But you have to be careful because the pointer, because it has that bizarre signal, because it is a lie that tells the truth, it's very vulnerable to being edited out. By you later in the process. You go, what does this mean? I don't understand. So you have to be careful.
Right. I mean, I've definitely had experiences like that with my own plays, where, and part of it is because it's a time-bound art, the payoff comes in a later scene. And so when you're just looking at that one early moment that has the pointer in it, it can feel like, this is not compelling. But that's because it has to rhyme with something later in order to work.
Yes, you're ready to teach my class. Yeah, the pointer is, the thing about a pointer is it has to stick out. Mm-hmm. It's actually in the chapter five of the book, where it says they have to have signal that'll make them stick out. Otherwise, you won't remember them. Mm-hmm. They have to be slightly anomalous. There has to be a little hook on them. If they resolve perfectly, then you're in trouble.
Right.
Because you won't hang on to it.
Right.
That's another thing that Martin McDonagh has. It's just genius. He can set something up once and you don't forget it.
Well, still often because it's so disturbing.
Well, there in his later work, yes. But in Beauty Queen, he has the dedication of the song to the mother. Mm. And you just hear about it once in the beginning. And then at the end of the play, it finally plays on the radio when Maureen is the one in the rocking chair instead of Mag. And Maureen has turned into her mother. It's breathtaking.
Well, Sherry, we're almost getting ready to wrap up, but we love to ask our guests this question. If you could have a dinner party and invite any three playwrights, living or dead, who would you want to have around your table?
Well, I really thought about this question. And unfortunately, I want to have Oscar Wilde three times.
Oh, that's amazing. Like different versions of him, or?
It could even be the same. I mean, not when the end, when he was really depressed. I don't want him after he's been to jail, okay, because I think that would be sad. But when he's at
pre-trial Oscar Wilde,
just three of them, because then I won't have to say anything. I'll be able to eat and just like watch them banter.
What would you put on the menu?
Oh, well, I don't know what Oscar would like, but I know what I would like. And I would like a scallop, a really good scallop potato. And then I would like prime rib, really good prime rib. And then I would probably go for twice baked potato. There'd be three potatoes. And then no French fries though. And then I would have a crispy Brussels sprout dish.
Ooh.
Because that's always my favorite. And then I would just have a lot of meat. I think I would have a lot of meat.
This is great. Sherry and three Oscar Wildes. And a lot of potatoes.
And steak.
Yeah.
And I could probably have a porterhouse too. I'd have a porterhouse, prime rib, and nothing fancy though. And then a surprise meat could make an appearance, but very red, very, very bloody.
Oh.
Yes. Do you have another question?
So I guess before we move on to Glisten's, one last question would be, I'm just trying to just take all this in because this conversation has been so amazing. I guess, Sherry, what advice would you give to our listeners out there who are just starting out, or maybe they're early career playwrights, theater artists? Any advice or any wisdom you would like to provide here?
I've given the same advice for like 30 or 40 years, and it hasn't changed. Find your collaborators.
Mm.
Find, the people in your peer group who excite you, who you trust, who you value, and work with them till the cows come home. The happiest artists that I know are the ones who have a strong connection to a group.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had trouble finding my collaborators, and then they died. I found a couple of directors who I worshipped, and then they died. So, but I never found a larger group.
That's heartbreaking.
That's the way that went.
Yeah.
But find your collaborators and make a lot and make as much work as you can with them. And in this point in our lives or in the theater time, do things other than be a playwright with them.
Yeah. Like what?
That's one of the things that I foster with my students here. When we used to do like a new play festivals, I would say, and those of, the playwrights who aren't having work done in this festival, you will stage manage, you will do crew, you will build the sets for the other playwrights.
Yeah.
And next time you'll be the playwright. But learn those skills and learn how to collaborate.
Oh, that was beautiful. That was really beautiful. All right. Okay, I'll do that. I'll do that.
Do that. Okay, bye.
Yes, Sarah. Are you going to build my set?
No, not your set. Your plays are... No way. all right, let's move on to Glistens. Sherry, so this is part of our show. We like to share our favorite Glistens of the week. It can be a music you learned, or maybe a headline, or something you just discovered, or something that enlightened you, or anything. It could be anything at all. I'll start. My son, August, I'm starting to see two little teeth going through. He's 8 months old, and I'm just like, I'm watching it so intently. I cannot stop looking at it, and I'm just waiting. I'm just waiting for these two, because he's teething, and it's driving him crazy, which is driving us crazy as parents, and we can't sleep. And so when we're just waiting for these two teeth just to come through so we can breathe again. So that is my glisten.
And they are glisteny, I guess. Really.
I mean, there are going to be more teeth after those, right?
And I'm just,
but
I'm just
I didn't want to say that. I didn't want to say that.
Wow. Great glisten.
Yeah. All right. Sam, what's your glisten?
Okay. My glisten is last night I went for the first time in like maybe 20 years, I went to a haunted cornfield with some of my friends called Terror in the Corn at this local farm. And I had no idea this, I mean, it was huge, first of all. They're like nationally ranked among haunted attractions. Who knew?
Wow.
It was maybe an hour long where we were going through this very dark cornfield. And then there were themed areas. It was like the Wild West, and we were going through all these buildings, and there was like a mine shaft, and it was really fun. And I just forgot how much fun it is to have, you know, like high school theater actors jump out at you in, you know, scary costumes. Really a lot of fun. 10 out of 10 would recommend.
Where do you live?
I live in Boulder, Colorado. So this is at a place called Anderson Farms. But I'm pretty sure there are haunted cornfields all over the country.
I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, you should. You absolutely should.
I'll see if there are haunted cornfields that are safe for geriatrics. They're handicapped. Okay.
There was a lot of frightful moments. But they did tell us at the beginning that we were not allowed to touch anyone, and they would not touch us. So that was reassuring. But, you know, it was like somebody chased us with a chainsaw. You know, there was like animatronic alligator. There was a point where we were walking through. It was supposed to be like a lagoon, and they had all this fog that kind of hung around us at waist level, and then they were projecting like watery lighting onto it. So it looked like we were walking through waist deep water.
That's cool.
It was really, I've never experienced anything like that. And I was like, this seems so obvious and simple for an immersive, you know, theatrical experience, but it's the first time I've experienced that. It was really cool. Mm-hmm. And you know, all of it was just very disorienting and super fun.
Oh, so delightful.
Yeah. Terror in the Corn. Sherry, what about you? What's your glisten?
Well, my glisten is a 180 degree turn from your glisten.
Okay.
And not in a good way. I have spent the last week, immersed in the conflict in Israel and Gaza.
Yes.
And we also... I teach on a college campus, and there are problems, and which we are trying to deal with. But I've been listening to the different news feeds, and different shows, and I heard, and now I don't know if you've all paid attention to this particular facet of it, but now the attack on the Israelis is called a pogrom, which of course it is. It is a state sanctioned violence against Jews, the killing of children, the indiscriminate killing of the unarmed children, old women. So it is a pogrom, which of course is a word that I have known my whole life. Normally, in the past, we always thought of it as the Russian and Polish.
Yeah.
In nature. But someone gave the definition of the word pogrom. And they said it is a word for the noise inside the thunder.
Whoa.
Which blew me away.
That's the definition.
Of pogrom.
Wow.
If I can believe what I hear. And you can't believe anything. Pretty much, but the noise inside the thunder, and what's interesting about it is that, to me, is that it sets up the fact that it's something much bigger that this is the noise of.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not even the thunder. Even though we think of thunder as noise, this right. is Bagram is a outcropping of something even bigger.
Something larger and
yes.
yeah, and more.
The thunder
dispersed.
Is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is just the noise inside the thunder. So that's the thing that really struck me this week.
Wow. Yeah, I'm going to be thinking about that for a while. Yeah. It's kind of like the power of language strikes me again and again, what it can okay. kind of capture about a moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Sherry, thank you so much for coming on our show. And listeners, you should all rush out right now and buy her book, which we now know is just part one. Hopefully oh we'll get a part two before
wait.
Long. But it's called Writing for Stage and Screen, Creating a Perception Shift in the Audience. And it's really good.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.